Cleveland TV Tales Volume 2 is now out, and we have Mike Olszewski, co-author, along with his wife Janice, put this together. Volume 1 kind of focused on the golden age of Cleveland TV, right? Goulardi, a lot of the early Page Palmer, the Dorothy Fuldheim. Are they included in this book at all?
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because we call that the first golden age. Yeah, a lot of those people are there. You know, we can't seem to get enough of Dorothy Fuldheim for some reason. So we put a lot of stories about Dorothy in there. She was quite a character in her day. And, you know, the great thing about Dorothy was she just didn't care what you thought. This is Dorothy Fuldheim. You either accept me or you don't. One day when they had the anniversary of the Afternoon Exchange, if you remember that show, they brought out champagne. Dorothy took a bottle and drank it right out of the bottle. And then she said, hey, by the way, this is cheap champagne.
She was a woman I always was interesting when I was growing up. And then you realized about her past, you know, one of those things. In other words, she was just an old redheaded woman on TV giving advice, scolding Joel Rose and other people like that. But yet she had such a stellar background. You know,
oh, very true, yeah. You know what? She grew up very poor in St. Louis. In fact, when her brother died, they had to bury him in an orange crate because they didn't have enough money for a coffin. However, her dad used to take her to court, and he'd say, listen to the way these attorneys speak. Well, she became just entranced with the way they spoke, and she became very well-written, very well-spoken, very well-educated on her own right. She became a network correspondent for a time in the 1930s and actually went to Germany to talk to Hitler. Now, she didn't let on that she was Jewish. She could speak fluent German. But when she came back, she said, this man is going to be the end of humanity unless we stop him. She walked off the air, walked into the program director's office at the network, and he said, if you ever give an opinion again, you'll be fired. Well, for the rest of her life, she just gave opinions.
Yeah, and most of the time, she was right, probably, on
darn
a lot
right.
of things.
Yeah, that's
man,
it.
You know, I miss those In My Opinion segments, those news segments where the people would sort of tell us what we were supposed to think.
Oh, yeah, that was like the voice of the people, Vox Populi type thing. And, you know, so often, they were able to say things because they were opinionated that many of us felt, but, you know, the anchors couldn't do it because they had to be as impartial as possible. Dorothy Fuldheim was one of those characters, and, you know, there were a few others as well, but I think she was the one that really stands head and shoulders above the rest.
This book not only focuses on daylight, but nighttime as well. And, of course, I mentioned Goulardi, Big Chuck, Little John. It's interesting, the whole range of horror hosts. Everybody, when you thought it was just your person, there's sometimes people in other markets that were having a very similar thing. So this is kind of like a trend across the United States, I guess.
Well, that's very true, but I'll tell you what. You had some people like Vampira out on the West Coast, and you had, his name escapes me right now, but the guy in New York, I'm sorry. At any rate, you know, Zacherly, I'm sorry, how can I miss Zacherly? Cleveland, by far and away, had the best horror host. We had Goulardi, who was a true innovator, and, I mean, you would tell Ernie Anderson not to do something, and he was an anarchist. He would go on the air and do it exactly the way that you told him not to. And then you had people like, the son of Ghoul, Kevin Scarpino. You have Janet Decay, who's doing some things now with Grim Gory, the mummy and the monkey, they call themselves. We just had the best people because they didn't depend on special effects. They depended on creativity. They could improv. They could come out. They could make you laugh. They would draw huge crowds wherever they do. And people like the Son of Ghoul and Janet Decay and Grim Gory are still around with us.
And they provided something to fill out the extra hours on television as it was growing and kind of forcing itself to be on the air longer than what they had programming for, it seemed. Sometimes.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of people don't realize that TV is still a relatively young medium. It came here in Cleveland in 1947, and when Goulardi hit the air in 1963, it had only been around for about 16 years. However, it was still such a powerful force that when over 90% of the homes in the greater Cleveland area had TVs in the early 1960s, when Ernie Anderson was on the air, the crime rate dropped 50% because both victims and the criminals stayed home to watch him.
Well, let's talk about those people who are awake in the morning, not the criminals.
Oh,
those
okay.
folks. the Morning Exchange. This was a very innovative program for its time, and even Good Morning America, I believe, was copied after that. It was a template for that.
It sure was. Oddly enough, an hour of Good Morning America actually shortened the Morning Exchange. When it first went on the air, we had a guy named Alan Douglas, who was a very volatile host. And he was the first host, along with Don Webster, of Alan Douglas's Morning Exchange. And it was originally supposed to be sort of like a swap and shop type thing. They actually had to drop two very popular programs to put it on in 1971. And that was Romper Room with Miss Barbara and the Page Palmer Show. And Paige Palmer would occasionally come out and do some exercise-type routines. However, it evolved into this talk type of thing where the exchange, instead of swap and shop, it was an exchange of ideas. Oddly enough, the long-standing host of the Morning Exchange, Fred Griffith, was never officially the host. He came in as sort of a fill-in. People loved him so much, they said, hey, let's just keep him here until he decides he doesn't want to do it anymore. Well, 20-some years later, I think he finally said, let's just let TV evolve in a different direction.
But his entrance into that program really is what put it the temper to that show.
There's no question. I mean, you know, David Hartman, there was talk that they chose David Hartman for Good Morning America because he so closely resembled the attitude and the demeanor of Fred Griffith. Fred Griffith was one of those guys where he was very erudite. You know, he always he used to say, "Why use one word when three good ones will suffice?" You know, he was very talkative, very chatty, and a flatliner. Nothing bothered him. But the great thing was he had a basis in news. He had worked at Wixie Radio for a time, along with Gary Ritchie, the news director, and they just knew the right questions to ask and how to get the most out of a guest. He was really one of a kind.
He seemed to be like one of those people that allows the guest to shine. He didn't need to be the person that was going to be talking all the time, or you know, getting all the limelight in a sense.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's exactly the way it was. He would actually just, you know, he wanted the real person to come through. And you, if you were in the green room talking to Fred beforehand, he was just there to joke around and, you know, bring out the real person in you. But you felt so relaxed around him that I always thought he would have been a great lawyer because, you know, you could tell him anything he wanted to hear.
Like Matlock, almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, very much like that, sure.
What about the topics? I mean, this is a time of the day where they're talking about a lot of different things. And, of course, not to bring anything else, but Phil Donahue was coming up at that time. But this is where afternoon talk took its way from game shows and sort of soaps to becoming, you know, things today that we're still talking about. They were originals on that type of show.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. The Morning Exchange and the Afternoon Exchange were so important that it made Cleveland into one of the top book markets in the country. And if somebody was going on tour, whether it was a little-known author or somebody who was very well-known, they always came to Cleveland first. And then the book publisher would be, the publicist would be on the line with the folks from the Morning Exchange saying, how did they do? If they did well, they're going on the rest of the tour. If not, they're going back to New York. They need some pointers.
Wow. The book is called Cleveland TV Tales, Volume 2. We're talking with Mike Olszewski this morning. You talk also, we mentioned the Morning Exchange Television, but TV news, which is sort of the personalities even today, that's kind of what we're left with now, is just
sure.
The news. Talk about the time and how Cleveland, we embrace our news anchors, the men, the women, the sports, the weather, who shows up. We want to embrace them. We want to make them ours. We put a stamp on it. We claim them almost.
Well, you know, we love our old personalities. And you know, quite honestly, look, Big Chuck Schadowsky's still on Channel 8. Dick Goddard's still on Channel 8. And next year, he's going to be celebrating 50 years on Channel 8, which is remarkable. Dorothy Fulton, if she were alive today, I would say that she would still be on TV. But these people become a part of our families. They, you know, we remember them from when we were kids, and we grew up with them. And even though TV and radio is sort of like a water faucet, you turn it on when you need it, turn it off when you don't, and you know it's there when you'll need it again. These are people that shape our lives. We have a friend out on the West Coast. He's a producer. And he said that there's a lot of people from Cleveland. If you go to a party and there's people from Cleveland there talking, you're not allowed in that conversation unless you're from Cleveland. What are they talking about? Well, the last time they were in Northeast Ohio or Cleveland Television.
Wow. And it's amazing that even if the people just go through here, we kind of keep them. You know, we have Al Roker. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't a native here. He came here for a while. We put a stamp on him. We always want him to be one of ours. I even see Kelly O'Donnell on the national news doing things from the White House.
Oh,
remember,
yeah.
When she was local here as well. So we kind of almost keep track of them. They're like children as they go off to bigger and better things, it seems.
It's funny you mention that because Al Roker loved Cleveland. He didn't want to leave Cleveland. And in fact, some of his family still lives in Cleveland. They moved here to be near him, and they still live here. But he wanted to go back to New York when he got the offer because he wanted his parents to see him on TV. People loved Al Roker. And I remember we were my wife and I got to know him and his wife pretty well, and we were out to dinner one night. And Al had to do a 6 o'clock cast. So he's coming out on a Saturday. It's a French restaurant. Everybody's yelling the same thing. Hey, Al, what's the weather? And he would walk over, put his arm around him, and he said, stick your head out the window. But, you know, he could say it in such a way that they laughed, they parted friends. Al Roker was always meant for something bigger. I remember once Willard Scott, if you remember Willard from the Today Show, he came to Cleveland, and he was sitting there with Al, and they got on very well, and they were doing a live shot on TV. And Willard Scott says, you know what, I crown you my successor. And he took his toupee off and put it on top of Al's head.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about the weather and sports. Sportscasters are another one, too. Any stories in here we can share?
Oh, boy. There's a thousand of them. You know, Casey Coleman. A lot of people didn't realize his first name was not Casey. Those were his initials. He was Ken Coleman Jr. And how do you come into a city where your dad is a legend and make a mark? Well, Casey managed to do it. He was very outspoken. He had his own personality. But then there were some other people you forget about, guys like Waylon Boot. Waylon came from the Pacific Northwest, and he liked it up there. But when he came to Cleveland, he was talking to a guy back in his home newspaper. And he says, yeah, Cleveland's not like Seattle or some of those cities. Well, it got back. You don't say stuff like that to a newspaper. It tends to come back. And Waylon was never really embraced the way some others were. Some of the names have come and gone. Thor Tolo. How many people remember Thor Tolo? And so many people, a lot of these guys had to, like, really take up after a legend had left or, passed on or whatever. And how do you do that? Because Cleveland will look and say, well, he's no Jim Greiner or something like that.
Let's talk about the investigative news.
Oh, boy,
and
yeah.
It's even the, you got Carl Monday, Tom Meyer, those are the two I remember. Anybody else that you can add to that list that
kind of started? Well, there's so many. Laurie Taylor's still doing them. Paul Orlowski, Bill Scheel, of course. In fact, I just saw Paul and Carl. They're both over at Channel 19. That's a rough business, and there's an even rougher business, being their videographer. Because if they say if somebody's going to come after you, they're going to get rid of the evidence first, get rid of the camera, then you go after the investigative reporter. Carl and Paul have been sued plenty of times and have never lost a case because they're just that good. Same thing with Tom Meyer. It's a rough business. I mean, they've been threatened. They've been, I don't know how many times you've heard that, they had special security surrounding them. And for a time, in the 1980s, Carl Monday had a listed phone number. Because he said he wanted people to call him with tips.
Well, that's how you get you work the street. That's how you get the information.
And that's it.
Of course, it is kind of, I don't know if it's still done the same because of the budgets and the time. It's a long process. Everybody wants something that was shot last night that they found on their phones that they post up there.
Yeah.
And then they kind of sort through it later. Whereas those kind of things, they kind of have to plot along in some sort of a slow pace. And I don't know if his media or us as consumers want to wait that long for something.
Well, the thing is, they expect a lot of, if you're an investigative reporter, you got to keep doing it every day. You might have a story that takes a week, but when that one's done, you better have one that's even bigger than that. You know, it's funny because Carl Monday, one of his most famous confrontations, maybe the one that lost George Forbes the mayor's race, was when he confronted George about a water bill that he didn't pay. And he owed $400, but he never had his water turned off. Well, those two knew each other from, when they were doing radio together. And there was a confrontation. And it became a very celebrated TV spot. And, in fact, Carl won an Emmy about that, for that story. Well, about 20 years later, on the 20th anniversary, Carl went back to talk to George Forbes. George was laughing, and he said, listen, I won that Emmy for you, so I want you to bring the Emmy. And he did. At any rate, he said, George, come on, why is it? You're an attorney. You're the president of the Cleveland City Council. Why did you not pay your water bill? And George said, my wife wanted a fur coat, and I didn't have the money.
You've got a lot of different stories. We got fun stories in here, some serious one as well. You detailed the whole sex scandal involving the Morning Exchange, Joel Rose.
Yeah, very sad case.
And
yeah.
You even have the one that I kind of remember has to do with the suicide on air, Bud Dwyer.
Wow.
That is one that, for television, that is really one of those moments where you're wondering, what am I seeing? What is happening here?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because Channel 5 ran that, and they actually showed the entire suicide. It is one of the most frightening things you've ever seen. Now, I'll tell your listeners this. You could see it on YouTube, but let me also warn you, you cannot unsee it once you've seen it. I mean, it's one of the most frightening things, and it was a live suicide right on the air. And the tape went around, and usually in something like that, you edit it. Channel 5 decided to run it, not once, but twice, and took a lot of flack for it.
Well, there's a whole lot of that if you work in the TV business, where you see things that come off the feeds, and you determine what the viewer is going to see. So there's obviously things. I know the one of the channels I remember watching it They basically went to a freeze frame, and you just heard the gunshot at some particular point like that. So.
You know, it's funny because Jan and I, my wife Janice and I, when we were writing this book, we were talking about that. That, you know, it's a case where a lot of these folks get out of the TV business because it's a lot like being an emergency room nurse or a MASH hospital or something. You know, you're seeing just so much of this every day. And you're probably going to see it the next day. And there's only so much you could take. It takes a special person to be a TV news person.
Maybe that explains why Marty Sullivan has an alter ego of Superhost. Here's a guy who's a news. That was the strangest thing as a child to suddenly realize, hey, Superhost, he's the guy that's doing the news later on at some point like that. You're thinking, I know there's not much of a disguise, and I understand that people wonder how Clark Kent and Superman can't be recognized. But as a kid, you're thinking, it can't be the same guy who was doing that goofy Saturday afternoon movie host.
The funniest thing was they used to do that live, the Superhost show on Saturdays, and they would tape the newscast ahead of time. So, like, during the movie, they would come up to Marty and say, okay, Marty, let's do that five-minute newscast. And he would simply rub off his red nose. He would put, except once when he forgot to, he would put on a jacket, a tie, and a shirt, and he would do the news from behind a podium. Well, we were able to find a photo of him doing the news where, from the top up, he's Marty Sullivan, newsman. From the bottom down, you see Superhost.
Well, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. If you're just out of the camera angle, you know, the camera gives you the perfect shot. Everything else is the magic of television if you're there.
Well, they say it's like, you know, it's like you don't want to see sausage being made, right. Put it that way.
Right, as well. Again, the book is
the finished product.
It's Cleveland TV Tales, Volume 2. Our guest today has been Mike Olszewski. This is just out, another chance for people in Cleveland to relive their past, pine for the glory days, but I guess we should embrace what's happening today, right? There's a lot of things. The future Mike Olszewski would write a book about what's happening in the new century.
You know, it's funny that you mention that because I also teach courses, and you know, radio and television changes, okay? But here's one thing that won't change. We're going to need programming. Just because the delivery is going to change, that doesn't mean that we're not going to need a lot of programming. In fact, as the delivery becomes a lot easier, that means we're going to need more programming than ever before. Well, that's good because, you know, if it's not under the strict restrictions of TV broadcast, you can have older people on the air or people that may have a different way of doing the news. Because there's going to be more opportunities. It's like your cable. I mean, you've got how many, 200, 300 channels on your cable? Well, it's become a lot more niche broadcasting. I will say this, though, as far as local broadcasting is concerned, we're not going to see people around for 20, 30 years like we did with Dorothy Fulltime, Captain Penny, Lynn Sheldon, all those people, because moods change and, you know, I'm obviously some people just decide it's better to go into something else. But we were very lucky to have seen the TV that we did up to this point.
Well, it kind of, I guess, makes Clevelanders who they are. It also influences the future generation by seeing somebody set a standard and they want to emulate that person or be like that.
That is so true. You know, it's funny because whenever I've worked with any of the old-time broadcasters and people will come up and say, I grew up with you, they put their hands over their ears because they think, I can't be that old. But their influence is really that great. I mean, when one of the biggest fans of Gene Carroll, if you remember Gene Carroll, was a guy named Don Novello. And Don Novello worked with all the biggest names in show business. He's Father Guido Sarducci from Saturday Night Live. But he loved Uncle Jake, and he loved Captain Penny, and when he was growing up, because he grew up in Lorraine. And he also loved, obviously, Gene Carroll and Barnaby, Lynn Sheldon. So it just shows you the far-reaching influence all of these people have on us.
And many of the programs we watch on television now have some Cleveland connection with the culture of the people who grew up here and then go become writers and put some influence into that as well.
Oh, so very true, yeah. Yeah.
I enjoy watching Patricia Heaton, who's on that middle show where there's some reference. It just sort of sometimes reeks of sort of Northeast Ohio mentality in a lot of that.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that because if you look at Dan O'Shannon, who wrote Modern Family, now does Odd Couple, and he's paired with another person from Warrensville Heights, that's Yvette Nicole Brown, Steve Scrovan, Ed O'Neill, who played Al Bundy, and now he's on Modern Family. Whenever they can, they sneak in a Northeast Ohio reference. Sometimes it's just an inside joke, but they might mention a radio personality. Or on Modern Family, Ed O'Neill, one day he mentioned Jeff Kutash. Jeff Kutash was the choreographer for the Upbeat show. And it just meant something to people in Cleveland. Any place else, are going, who's that? You know.
Well, I'm trying to still figure out the reference to Cliff Bemis on the credits of the Grindr show as the actual producer of the show. Cliff Bemis, who done Jacques Brel in Northeast Ohio as well. His name is put in there, and supposedly, who knows where that's going to go. But there's always interesting references out there for people. It's kind
of sometimes they do it just, you know, as a tip of the hat, you know, a nod to somebody who's very influential. If you watch the old Carol Burnett shows, every once in a while she'll introduce Ernie Anderson in the audience. Well, Ernie only was only in the audience once. They just kept using that same clip over and over.
Oh, did he get royalties for that?
Knowing that guy, he was pretty well off. I wouldn't be surprised if he did.
He knew it's where to make the coin, that's for sure. The book Cleveland TV Tales, Volume 2, our guest Mike Olszewski. Mike, thanks for sharing the details. Book's available everywhere out there, and people who love Cleveland TV will love this book. Thanks.
Well, I'm very honored, and go out and buy the book, and we'll do another one after that. How's that?
Thanks very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.